I was going to ask if you want to reserve any of your time.
Yes, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Sure.
May it please the court, I'm McMillan Powers, and I'm here for Raynard Brown. He was initially tried on a first-degree murder indictment and the use of a firearm in the commission of that felony, and the verdict of the jury was a manslaughter conviction, and to which he was then sentenced. The way we get from the first-degree murder to the manslaughter is why we're here today. Mr. Brown's defense was that he was not sane at the time of the commission of the offense. We've already been through, this court's already articulated the idea of affirmative defenses. It's the defendant's burden to prove to the satisfaction of the jury, and the instructions that were given to the jury in this case firmly and clearly articulated what the law in Virginia is about that defense and what he had to prove. He had to prove that he was not sane at the time that offense was committed. And what we believe happened is that in the testimony of our expert, Dr. Williams, he was able to go through not only his interview with the client, but also his review of the client's medical records and his medication record, and as a result of his personal involvement with the client, was able to say that he was suffering from a schizoaffective disorder, which is a kind of combination of schizophrenia and a bipolar disorder, and came to the conclusion that he did not have, this is the defendant, did not have the ability to distinguish right from wrong, or to understand the nature and the character of the consequences of his actions, which is clearly what the defendant has to prove. That's what our expert
stated.
But
if an expert witness testifies to that, is the fact finder or the jury required to accept it?
No. I will concede that you do not have to absolutely accept that at face value. However, at this point, the Commonwealth, for whatever reason, believes that's evidence that is convincing enough that they must put on rebuttal evidence. And they do. This is my position on that. The Commonwealth easily could have put on Dr. Zwemer in their case in chief to say this man is sane.
Isn't there a presumption of sanity?
Yeah, I was going to say it wouldn't be relevant in their case.
It wouldn't be relevant. But what I'm saying is, if they think that my client is insane, if they think he's sane, then they're going to put on some evidence that does that in their rebuttal. They did not put on any evidence in their rebuttal. That's what I'm saying. I meant saying their rebuttal.
Dr. Zwemer testified that your client was malingering when he examined him, but he couldn't opine as to what his mental condition was at the time of the offense, correct?
Right. Directly asked that question, which was articulated specifically and correctly by the Commonwealth's attorney, do you have an opinion within a reasonable degree of medical certainty? Exact right question. The answer is no. At that point, whatever else is said is explanation, and clearly he can explain that. But at that point, and if you look at the record, I believe it begins about 508 in the appendix, 510, 513, through that area where Dr. Zwemer is testifying, not only does he say no to the essential question, one expert says yes, other expert says, I can't form an opinion. I don't have an opinion. Do you have an opinion? No. Then he goes ahead and testifies not only to what he believes.
Well, he did offer an opinion that he did not suffer from the various mental maladies that your expert testified to.
He said, I think the testimony is there that there's no record that really substantiates that.
I think he testified really he administered out. Certain psychological tests to your client.
Yeah.
He examined his hospital records. He examined the records of these two other physicians as well and reached a certain opinion as to his malingering and his lack of symptomology with respect to some of the other matters that your expert testified to. But I understand your key point is he clearly said, I have no opinion as to what his mental state was
at the time of the offense. And that's the key issue here. The rest of the stuff.
But how is it key? In other words, if all that testimony is before the fact finder to do with as they will, and they're instructed on the law as to how to apply it, and we presume they did that. So how, if the law is not wrong and the facts are unobjected to before the fact finder, Where does that leave us as an appellate court in terms of how you want us to deal with that situation?
Respectfully, I think that's where the court has it in error. It was objected to, and this is the issue as to whether or not that objection is there. The objection as to the hearsay nature of what Zimmer is going to testify to and the lack of ability to do a confrontation on the Sixth Amendment, all of that is objected to and put
before the court. Well, that's objected. Let's parse that out if we can, because as I understand it, Zimmer did a couple of things. He offered his opinion based on his administration of certain tests and his review of certain records, and he offered his opinion as to the mental state of your client at one point in time, but not at another point in time. That was not objected to, as I understand it. What was objected to was the further statement that he made with respect to Drs. Shineman and Tinsley agreeing with me, correct?
Correct, but his testimony as to his mental, the defendant's mental state at a point in time is not at the point in time that matters legally, which is the time of the offense.
Well, experts can rely on hearsay evidence to reach an opinion. Their opinion is what comes into evidence.
The opinion comes into evidence, but his opinion has to be based under the rules in Virginia, has to be based on his personal observation and evidence that's already in record.
Didn't he make personal observation? He spent an hour and a half.
He didn't make personal observation. The problem is, and this is the problem in this case, and this is why we're here. The problem is the mix of his personal observation with all of the hearsay. He, in fact, if you look in the record, and I believe it begins about page 509, 510, if you look there, Dr. Zimmer now begins to state the opinions of the other two doctors. And so he is now then becomes, he's testifying as to what their opinions are. All of that was objected to before the testimony ever gets out.
Well, that's what I'm having trouble.
And that's the issue.
That's, Mr. Power, that's what I'm having trouble with, because I'm looking at the record. I see no objection. What I do see is a sidebar that took place that occurred during Dr. Zimmer's testimony with respect to Dr. Shineman's impression. And so there's a sidebar that's not recorded, not in the record anywhere. And then the court says, all right, go ahead, counsel. And then the prosecutor then begins resuming questioning with respect to what Dr. Shineman at Central State said. And there's no further objection in the record. So I'm at a loss to understand where this is preserved.
It is preserved, and I believe it's an, if you look at, I believe the record is 530 and 531 in the record, where the court, when all of the smoke's cleared and the dust is settled, the court comes back and acknowledges at the time of the motions to strike, acknowledges your objections were preserved. We did all this before.
Can you give me that page number?
I think it's 530 and 531.
530.
I believe that's where the court actually articulates that.
So it's well after the testimony.
It's after the testimony, but the court is saying we did. This is. I get off another.
Is this reference to the sidebar or something?
This is in reference to the sidebar,
okay.
And it says, I know what your objection is, and I overrule your objection, and the judge was wrong to do that. That's the issue we have here today. That hearsay foundation for Zimmer's testimony was objectionable, was objected to, and should not have been allowed. He can only testify to his personal observation and facts already in record and answer the hypothetical question. That's what experts do. He did not testify in that way, and the continuing objection is there, which has been approved by this court.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
In light of the nature of his testimony, can you address harmless error?
Harmless error is, clearly we have to get to that error, that issue. The point here is, on the record that's here, there is, you cannot look at this record and read Zimmer's testimony as to the opinions of other psychiatrists and psychologists and say that that was not harmless error. You can't
but
say that it was harmless.
That's not the way harmless error. But that's not the way a harmless error analysis works.
But I'm saying when you look at all these facts, but for that testimony, you can't get to this decision. The motion to strike should have been granted on the basis that this error is clearly, it's just clear he's wrong. He should not have done that. The court was wrong to allow that testimony in. The rule says it. Simpson says it. All the cases that follow on the use of experts in testimony at trial, all of those cases say this is not the way you do expert testimony. And because of that, the error is there. So it's just a legal error. You're done.
Does it make any difference? Have. I didn't mean to interrupt you before you had finished answering Judge Dacker's question. Had you finished?
Yes, go ahead.
Does it make any difference that he performed the same psychological tests, or at least one of them, that the doctors at Central State did?
I don't know that it makes a lot of difference. That there's a lot of redundancy in the testing.
Well, certainly that would show that maybe that was his independent decision and he was not relying on
it. It could have been. And I will agree that the record is not as clear as it should be on parsing out what error is from the testimony of Dr. Zwemer and what error is testimony that he's relying on a hearsay. That's not clear. And I think that is a result of the continuing nature of the objection. The whole thing was objected to, and I think that what trial counsel does is they relied on that. Maybe I'm hearing from the court that that was not what they should have done, but that's what was happening. That testimony was coming in over their objection. We objecting to all of it, and it's all wrong because of what's plainly the law in Virginia as to how testimony comes from experts. So I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Yeah, I'm actually going to give you the full 5 minutes because Judge O'Brien asked you that question. So that's all right. That's all right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Good afternoon. Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth here. Judge O'Brien, one of your questions, I think, hit on one of the issues in this case, and this actually goes back to Simpson, and this case has talked about it in Jones. If you can look at the record and see that there was an independent basis for the opinion, that's adequate. It was Dr. Fierro. This usually seems to come up with medical examiners because that was true in Simpson as well. Dr. Fierro was the witness in Jones. And you do have, you have an expert here who did a significant amount of his own work. He administered a test that where he talked about the defendant latching on to a symptom that would indicate he was malingering. He did three examinations. He specifically said that this claim of amnesia was not credible given the psychological history. Now, there was some back and forth because this individual apparently, there was some reporting of a traumatic event when he was 9 years old, but during redirect, I believe it was, he said, you know, maybe the hallucinations that he's talking about would be consistent with that type. He saw his brother drown, according to the information we have, when he was nine. But not these, I think he referred to them as auditory or command hallucinations, where someone is actually telling, the voice is telling me to do something bad. He said that's not consistent with PTSD, which...
Well, Mr. Jeffrey, I understand Mr. Powers' argument, at least in part, to be... because the Commonwealth offered this testimony in rebuttal to the expert, their experts saying essentially my client is insane, or at least has a medical condition that satisfies the legal definition of insanity at the time of the offense, and the Commonwealth's expert could not opine otherwise, that it was, I understand the objection to basically be everything then becomes essentially worthless from the standpoint of rebut. In other words, didn't rebut anything, therefore, you know, the testimony somehow stands. What's your response to that?
Right. I have a couple of responses, and that really transitions us to the second issue, and I'll be happy to go back to the first if somebody has questions. But on the first one still, but I think what you have here, as I pointed out on brief, an uncontradicted expert opinion, and that's clear under McLean and its progeny, a jury can reject that. But I think what you had from Zwemer, I guess is how it's pronounced, everyone seems to be wrestling with that, including me, it was more subtle, as I pointed out on brief. You know, first of all, what you had here, he testified, as I talked about, as I said, about the auditory commands. He indicated that he thought that the amnesia thing was fabricated, and I think that's very big in this case, because I think even without that, this was a jury question. But what he was essentially saying, and I really didn't tie this together on the brief, perhaps as well as I did when I got this prepared for argument, was if he had told me what was going through his mind at the time he committed this offense, I might be able to opine on this. But essentially, what I'm telling you in a nutshell is that he's fabricating this whole notion that he doesn't remember anything, which is precluding me from actually giving you an opinion on that. And I think that's a very significant fact in this case.
So is this as simple as essentially their expert opines, I've examined him contemporaneously before trial, and he suffers, based on my analysis, suffers from certain mental conditions that in my opinion existed at the time of the offense, and another expert who says, and I've examined him contemporaneously before trial, and he's malingering and doesn't suffer from any of those things, but I can't opine as to what his condition was at the time of the offense. Draw your own conclusions. That's
I think that, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's all right. That was pretty well done.
I think that is what you have here. Now, I mean, honestly, if you didn't have the fact of the malingering.
So I guess then the next question, the legal question to answer is that proper rebuttal?
Is it proper? Oh, absolutely, because I think what he testified to undermined the reliability. I mean, it might not have been squarely contradictory because he wasn't able to opine why, but you know, X versus Y, but I do think that what he did certainly undermined the reliability of the expert opinion from the defense, which I think does make it fair.
And then Mr. Power's secondary argument is that the opinion in any event is undermined because it relies upon hearsay, inadmissible hearsay.
That's back to the first issue.
Yeah, that's back. I'm taking you back to the first
issue. Okay, that's fine.
And while we're at it, I mean, I know Judge Decker's going to ask about harmless error anyway, so I might as well ask it for her.
Okay. This court has referred to the type of error, the type of analysis that was done in Simpson and then later Jones as harmless error. You've done that in at least one case, so I think that's what we have to sort of accept at face value. That's what it is. And I would, a couple of responses. First of all, this court said in Jeter, and I cited that in the brief and in a footnote, and the court talked about it and the Supreme Court did in Countryside, if there is a problem with foundation of an expert opinion, you have to move to strike the expert's testimony on admissibility grounds, not sufficiency grounds. That was not done here. So I think that's one issue you've got floating through this case. And I think part of the reason and part of what keeps you from doing this harmless error analysis is because, as Mr. Powers admits on brief, we really can't completely sort out the wheat from the chaff here in terms of what was from his own analysis and what might have been from the experts. And I guess take it to the next level and deal with the objection, which I think is still vague as to what he exactly objected to here. Would his opinion have changed if he hadn't had that? He certainly did a significant amount of evaluation on his own.
Well, what's your understanding of the law of Virginia as to what experts can and cannot rely upon in formulating an opinion that they're going to offer at a trial?
My understanding post-Simpson, which of course has been on the books and under 703, we have a bit of an anomalous rule in that regard, as I know the court's aware, is that you can rely on your own observations and you can rely on hypothetical questions based on information that's in evidence. Now, I believe Mr. Powers said this. If he didn't, I don't think there's any dispute in this case. Those actual reports of Tinsley and Sheneman, and I think there was some suggestion there were some others, maybe some central state records, were not actually in evidence here. So. That's my understanding of the rule.
And again, it's anomalous. And clearly, Drs. Wimmer both reviewed them and, at least implicitly, it seems to me, relied to some extent upon them in terms of formulating his own opinion. So how do we parse that out? Or do we just go to a harmless error analysis and assume it's error?
I guess I have multiple responses because it's clear that he relied on that somewhat. I think if you look at the objection, we transitioned from the objection at page 509, I believe it is, to you've got reports from two different experts, and this thing that happened on page 530 of the appendix, there's no indication that there's a continuing objection. So we don't know, we certainly don't know for sure. I mean, the most charitable view is maybe Sheneman, but it's not clear that he objected to the Tinsley malingering information.
Mr. Jeffrey, how much of that, though, was based on the trial judge and not so much on defense counsel? Because there obviously was the discussion up at the bench, and then the judge essentially opened the door toward the end and said, in light of everything that's gone on, essentially took responsibility for for it to some extent.
I think to some extent, but of course, the burden is still on the defendant to provide an adequate record. Now, of course, there are some cases where somebody is, it's clear on the record, somebody's absolutely cut off at the knees. I don't think you have that here.
Well, you would agree that there was a sidebar where apparently an objection was made, and rather than send the jury out, they chose to, the judge apparently ruled on it at sidebar, and then at the first opportunity when the jury was excused, there was an attempt to make a record. Whether it's adequate or not, I guess, is subject to debate. But is that a fair description of what apparently occurred here?
Oh, I think that is fair, but we then have,
I know what your objection is, and basically I'm overruling it. I mean, that's Judge Decker's point. And counsel was in the process of arguing both a constitutional confrontation issue without much detail because the judge cut him off, and also a hearsay evidentiary issue without much detail because the judge cut him off, right?
But again, there was certainly the opportunity post-trial to develop this to some extent. And I think if you look at that testimony, it's about 510 to 513 of the appendix. We then have, I think the most charitable view you can take from this record is maybe absolutely to Shenneman, but then we're offering more information from Tinsley. There's no indication it was a continuing objection, totally different information from Tinsley. And I think that's part of the problem here. And I think also part of the problem, and I'll go back to what this court said in Jeter, and I'll talk about what the Supreme Court said in Countryside. If there is a foundation problem, and that's what the Supreme Court said in Simpson, if there is a foundation problem, you have to move to strike the expert's testimony, because you then have the very problem that we have now in this case before us. We have no idea how pivotal that information is, and I guess part of the issue is, if this had been done correctly, we might have at least been able to ask the expert, okay, back all that stuff out that you know from Tinsley and Shenneman and everything else, Central State, wherever else you know this from, and based on your own evaluation, where are you with respect to what your opinion is? And none of that was ever done. And I think it's a combination of a record problem. I think it's a combination of failing to move to strike the expert's testimony in toto. Which has to be done under I'm taking that right out of case law.
Let me ask you about the constitutional issue, because I think the evidentiary issue is frankly more problematic. But from the standpoint of the confrontation clause, the information has to be testimonial. We don't have a whole lot of information in the record, but I gather we're talking about records created by two doctors at Central State Hospital for a patient's treatment. Does Commonwealth have a position about whether that the testimonial information is subject to the Sixth Amendment, or whether it's outside of the Sixth Amendment protection?
I think the record could have been clearer on that, Judge Humphreys. I think that there may have been some indication that that was evaluations associated with either this or some other criminal case. I cited, by the name of the case is eluding me, one of the Supreme Court of Virginia confrontation cases on brief.
There aren't that many of them, so.
Right. And I can't seem to remember all two of them at this point for some reason.
I think it was Justice Scalia and Crawford said it's got to be created for the hearsay information has to be created for the purpose of trial. Now, of course, that may well be the case with an insanity defense, or it may be for treatment. I mean, we're talking about a hospital here, so
right.
We don't know which.
One of the takeaways we have from Sanders, and that's one reason, Sanders is the case, by the way, it took looking at my table of authorities to remember it, but one of the takeaways from Sanders is that if there is a dual purpose, the fact that it may have been prepared in part for a criminal proceeding does not necessarily make it testimonial. And I think that's kind of where we are. And the other language in Sanders that I would sort of commend to the court's reading on this, I'll certainly be up front with you and tell you I don't think this is crystal clear in terms of this particular case and these particular facts, but they talk about the evils in Melendez-Diaz of essentially you're going to have somebody come in and read a certificate. This is the result of the test, and essentially you're sneaking that in without the ability to confront the analyst. And I think what you have here is certainly more subtle, because you have an expert talking about malingering and things of that nature. So the chief evil that they talked about in Sanders referencing Melendez-Diaz, I don't think you have here. But no, I would absolutely agree with your premise, though, Judge Humphreys, and I think that is consistent with Sanders. If it was at least in part for treatment, you don't necessarily have a problem with confrontation or it being testimonial. To be perfectly frank, I like the court looked at this and always thought the Simpson 703 issue was the more difficult one here because of the way our state law is substantively. I think that the arguments that I've made on brief with respect to the record, the adequacy of the record, both with respect to what, you know, what exactly was from his own observations and what was from other things that he looked at, and also with respect to what exactly was objected to, I think that's equally fits both the state and the federal constitutional analysis in this case, which is why I didn't spend a lot of time parsing that out. But it seems to me that that is the issue that you have here. And I'm sorry, Judge Becker, I think I cut you off.
I was waiting for you to finish Sixth Amendment so we could bounce you back to the evidentiary issue. I have a question on the evidentiary.
We're playing rope-a-dope with you today, yeah. I think so.
I think that's all I had to say, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Okay, so what is the effect of, on 527 in the appendix, you have, when asked whether he agreed with Dr. Williams regarding the appellant's mental state at the time of the offense, Zwirmer responded, "No, I don't. And I had access to information beyond that to which he had access, and I think that's the reason." What is the impact of that?
It's not clear what that is. You know, certainly he had a lot of his own observations. He did three evaluations. You know, he certainly talked about that, and it seems to me if you look at the entire record, again, I think you have an adequacy of record problem is ultimately how this case comes down. We don't know how far the objection went. I think there's certainly a good argument here it didn't go to Tinsley, or it's not clear that it went to Tinsley. So that piece of information may be fair game and in the mix. That's part of my response to you.
So your point is the word information, access to information, could have just as easily been his own observations and the interview with the mother and the girlfriend and the...
Well, and I think the defense expert also interviewed the mother and the girlfriend, but he certainly did more evaluations. I think that's clear on the record. And he made it clear one of the reasons you do this is sometimes you get conflicting information. So I think, again, in toto, we don't have clarity in the record as far as how much this affected his opinion. And I guess, you know, I'm going to go back. I'm going to hit Jeter, and I'm not going to try to be disingenuous. Judge Humphreys wrote Jeter, so he may go back in the back and tell you I don't understand that footnote. But the way I understand that footnote, and I think it is consistent with what the Supreme Court of Virginia said in Countryside Corp. v. Taylor, is that if there is a foundation problem, you have to move to strike the expert's testimony. Otherwise, you've got the mess we have here right now where we're all trying to look at things like you just did and say, what the heck was he talking about? We don't really know for sure. And I think that's a fatal procedural defect in this case, and it would have made this much easier to either sort it out. I mean, I would suggest to you, and I'm only winging this, but I would suggest to you that had the question been posed to Zwemmer, based on what the amount of evaluation that he did, his answer may have very well have been, my opinion's not quite as strong, but yeah, I can still come down and say that. And I think that's part of the problem you have here. I couldn't stand up here and say that. I don't think if he hadn't done quite a bit of his own work, obviously. But if you look at this record, I think it screams out at you. His qualifications were also impeccable for what that's worth. And I don't mean to demean the defense expert. If you look at the defense experts, the experts here were phenomenal. They both had years of experience in their training, and things were phenomenal on both sides of this. But I think that's what you had here. But you know, and Countryside also made clear, by the way, what the footnote really talks about is that's a procedural argument. The appellee made the argument that testimony, an expert's valuation testimony, was should have been struck on appeal. And there wasn't a motion to strike the testimony until post-trial, and the court there said it was adequate. This could have been done post-trial. That footnote in Countryside makes that very clear. So that, I think, is a very fundamental procedural issue at the core of this case. is the failure to move to strike the expert's testimony, because as I said, it's not clear. And of course, as the court knows, not clear is the appellant's problem, not the appellee's. I don't mean to suggest to you that it's easy. 703, as Judge Humphreys alluded to, is a very difficult issue, but again, I would suggest to you that part of the problem with this record is you can't do the kind of analysis that's mandated under Simpson, Jones, and again in Patterson. This court referred to it as harmless error, which was, of course, the question you asked Judge Decker. That's where this is sort of compromised in the record. I think I covered sufficiency back to the second issue.
So you're 3 minutes past your time.
I did not realize I talked that long.
No, that's all right. I was enjoying you brown nosing, so that's all right.
It's rare Judge Humphreys gets the opportunity to enjoy that.
Touche.
At some point, the rope-a-dope has to end. On that note, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment below.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Jeffrey. Ms. Powers, you have 5 minutes.
With reference to Jeter, I think with all the analogies on the table, we can just say error and put us on base, because I think that there's a problem here even more fundamental, and that is the two issues that we've already talked about. One is the mix of the hearsay and the impermissible information that the doctor had, and I think Judge Decker, when you pointed out one of the judges pointed out on page 527 in the record, and then you want to look at a harmless error analysis, and Simpson's language is that you have a sufficient factual basis, an independent sufficient factual basis to form that opinion. And based on what he says and what he confesses in response to that question, It is so murky. It is impossible. And I will agree with counsel that the record is mixed together, and parsing that out is, fortunately for me, your job.
Well,
in the
wait
sense
a minute,
of trying to figure
wait
out whether or not there's harmless error.
Wait a minute. What about Mr. Jeffrey's point that the reason it's so murky
is because we have to present a record that is adequate under Smith. I've been there. I've done that. I've lost that case. I understand how that works, and I understand what it is for appellant's obligation to present a record. Well, whether or not we would have filed a post-trial motion to clarify that record, or whether or not the record should have been clarified at the point. Clearly, at the time, other things could have been done. But in the royal and turmoil,
well, and one
it
of those
happen.
Things, what's your response to Mr. Jeffrey's point that under Jeter, what should have happened was not just an objection to hearsay, but a motion basically to strike the entirety of the expert's testimony?
That did not occur. I will admit that did not occur. I don't know why that did not happen. I'm not sure what.
We understand you were trial counsel. We're not blaming you for
that. I'm not trying to blame trial, throw them under the bus. I'm just saying I have no idea why that happened or why that did not happen. I don't know if that was part of the sidebar that we're objecting to this and we're striking it. We want to strike it off. I don't know what was said there, and that record was not perfected and kept. And if nothing else comes from this case, and I say this sincerely, if nothing else comes from this case, I would implore this court to say at some point, trial court, please conduct your sidebars on the record out of the presence of the jury contemporaneously. We suffer with this time and time and time again, and I've been before this court time and again on that very issue of the objection is made. Can I approach? I approach, and then we have this little conference and say, can I put it on the record? Can we take these people out? No, we'll get to that later. And the later is what happens here.
Have you ever asked the judge to have a court reporter up
yes.
there at the sidebar?
Routinely.
And the judge has said no?
Routinely.
Okay.
Routinely. Say, no, we're not doing that, we're just going on. We'll get to that later. You can put all of it on the record later. And sometimes it gets put on the record later. That's counsel's problem if it doesn't. But many times, there's never the opportunity. And even when it's done later, that conversation is not the fire and brimstone of right there at the time when counsel are opposing to each other. Now you've got a more considered thing, maybe get better arguments, maybe it's better, I don't know. But what needs to happen, and at some point, some dictum, somewhere, in some case, needs to say, bench, you need to do this, you need to force that to happen. I understand why they don't do it, but it is not that inconvenient. We try in our office so many jury cases, but relative to the number of cases tried, it is an insignificant number. And so when the jury is inconvenienced for 10 minutes, that's the price we pay. And I don't have any problem with them being excused 16 times in a half an hour if that's what it takes. But I don't have the ability to tell courts to do that. You do. If nothing else, I would implore you to tell them to do it and to do it that way. That eliminates many of these problems. Anyway, getting back to the one last issue, and I'll just mention this in confrontation, going back to the Sanders case that was just talked about, quoting from Sanders, it says that an expert's use of testimonial hearsay is a matter of degree. Boy, is that where we are now. The question is whether the expert is, in essence, giving an independent judgment or merely acting as a transmitter for testimonial hearsay, and Zwemer was an instrument of testimonial hearsay because he was talking about the opinions of the other two psychiatrists.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. We have a number of spectators that have come in, and let me explain our tradition. Between cases, we will come down and greet counsel and then take up the next case, which is Rankin versus Commonwealth.